Okay. My writing and my research is in the area of Mormon women and personal agency. I wrote a book on New Wings that the premise of the book is that oftentimes Mormon women, as Mormon women, we unwittingly usually abdicate our free agency, the divine gift of our free agency, to the church, male authority figures, maybe our parents, the neighbors, the dog, whoever. And that when we do, that God knew that we needed to know that we were in control of our lives. He gave us our free agency because he knew how important it was to us. And that when we do that, there are always negative consequences. I'm just summing this up very quickly so that we can move on. We get really resentful. We're angry. We act like martyrs. Sometimes we even get sick, mentally and physically, as our resident psychologist can testify. The knowledge that we're in charge of our lives, that we're free to make whatever choices are meaningful to us, is essential. Recognizing, of course, that there are always consequences, but that knowledge is absolutely essential to our health and our happiness. Now, I really haven't studied how men fit into this picture. All of my writing and research has been directed toward women and is about women. And in fact, I've studiously tried to avoid putting men into the picture. I can remember once getting my hair done, and the hairdresser, you know, the hairdresser chit-chat, and she said, you know, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a writer. What are you doing? I'm writing a book. What are you writing about? Well, you know, Mormon women in free agency. Well, we'll have to make sure our husbands read that. And to me, the point was, no, it doesn't matter if our husbands read that. We already have our free agency. It's just up to us to start using it and to take it. So when I proposed the original panel, which we had this morning, about Mormon women and issues of free agency, as a side note to Sunstone, I suggested that it might be fun to address these issues from a male standpoint, of which I have no experience. I guess what I'm trying to say is, this is a disclaimer. I have no idea what they'll say or what they think. I'm no authority when it comes to men's issues, and it will be it's okay. It will be just as interesting to me today to hear what they have to say. Now, I'd like to begin by introducing my panelists in the order in which they'll speak. I'm going to have Dave Newbold speak first because I'm the most nervous about him speaking because he happens to be my husband. And he is here today because the panelists that I tried to get couldn't be here. And when he watched me for 3 days trying to get a replacement and agreed to come. Now, I should say that it's not that I didn't want him here. I originally asked him if he would be interested in being on this panel, and he graciously declined. But when he saw that I was foaming at the mouth in desperation, he agreed to come. And I have no idea what he'll say. So this man is not to be controlled. As far as biographical data, he has a bachelor's degree from BYU in advertising and has won numerous awards for his work in that field, and is currently the creative director of Bonneville Communications, and is a wonderful father and husband. We have 4 daughters and a baby son. Keith Allred, right here, I chose to be on the panel because he was married and has since been divorced from the very sort of woman that I write about in my book, a woman who did not believe or could not see that she had her free agency. And how? What does it feel like as a man to be married to that sort of a woman? And Keith did his undergraduate work at BYU, got his law degree at the University of Chicago, and is now a partner with Davis Wright Tremaine Law Firm in Seattle. And he is the single father of 2, and has raised his children. You can tell him. And then I chose Austin to be on the panel. Austin Childs here on the end because I thought that he might have some interesting professional thoughts on the subject, and I'm not sure what he'll be saying, but I originally wondered if he might want to help the men in the audience who might currently be dealing with the sort of situation that Keith was in. And then, did I say his biographical data? No. Austin has a PhD in clinical psychology from BYU, and he's currently the director of Rocky Mountain Counseling, and also has a private practice. And he is married and the father of four children. And finally, we will have Grant Boswell. I asked him to speak because he's in my sister's ward in Provo, and she told me that Grant and his wife Lisa were both very interesting, introspective people who were interested in women's issues. And Grant has chosen to talk about how Mormon women aren't the only ones who sometimes feel confined in a choiceless world. And Grant is did his undergraduate work at the University of Southern California, and earned his PhD at BYU, all of those in English. And he is now Associate Coordinator of Composition in BYU's English Department, and he's married and the father of two children. So we'll go ahead and start with Dave.
Gee, being the only one up here that's only had 4 years of college, I feel like she's getting me out of the way first so you can get to the people with substance. And she has worked hard to put this together, and I was glad to see her do it. She's nervous about me being up here because I'm the guinea pig behind the book that she wrote, in a way. And we often chide among ourselves that I don't really think, I just kind of feel, and that's how I act on life. And as a result, for instance, when we were first married, I just kind of felt like every lady, every woman in the church felt like I did, was raised kind of the way I was raised to see women in the church, and therefore she would fall properly in line and be a spitting image of my mother, and obviously there's lots of stories that go into that, whether you're in the church or not. And things would be just marvelous. And I have learned, some through sad experience, some through happy experience, that's not the case. And I have found that our marriage and our family is much better for it as a result. Now, Gail wanted me to touch on a couple of topics. First of all, is maybe the mixed emotions that a man would have, whether he's Mormon or not, about the issue of his wife's personal agency, free agency. He may believe that she'd be happier if she used that agency to do what she wants to do, but in reality, he realizes that her pursuing those dreams may translate into some troubles in the marriage and some conflict and some sacrifices in particular on his part. And that's not cool because Dad always used to come home from work, say, boy, I worked, I did my job for the family, put his feet up, and say, okay, let's have some dinner, and then I'm going to read the paper, and, yeah, get those kids to bed, kind of a thing. And, the husband, or myself in particular, at the beginning of marriage said, well, I would prefer to have you home managing the home, taking care of the kids, providing services that I have come to expect and enjoy because I thought that's the way it was supposed to be, plus that's the way my dad always got it, and therefore I should as well. The thought of the wife using her agency to actually do something that she wanted to do or felt like she could do or should do may seem threatening. It certainly seemed threatening to me, and I thought not only to our marriage but to the family. I could see conflict arising, and therefore, what's going to happen to the kids? Well, I think the classic example of how it all started, or a good example of when I started maybe to think a little bit instead of feel, was when we were first engaged and we were at BYU, we went to our two branch presidents. Now, Gail had this branch president, and we went to him first, who said, now remember, absolutely no birth control, you should have children immediately after you get married, that's the way it should be, and the wife should obviously stay home and take care of those children. And in retrospect, I can imagine how traumatic that must have been for Gail. Well, I was sitting there, quite honestly, saying, Yeah, that's kind of the way I've always heard it was supposed to be.
Cool.
Okay. And then we went to my branch president, a fellow by the name of Vernon Law, who had been a baseball player for the Pittsburgh Pirates, a great guy, and he sat down and amazed me in particular, because he said, "Now you two, I want you to kind of cool your jets a little bit on the children thing. In fact, me and my wife, we waited about a year and a half, 2 years to have kids, and that might not have been long enough." He said, "You need to spend some time getting to know each other, which obviously means you need to figure out what you want to do with birth control, and then decide what's best for you and your family, okay, you and your wife." And it was funny because I walked out of that interview saying, you know, I feel like that makes more sense, but what will the church think, or what will my staunch LDS parents think? What will the ward think? What will friends think if we decide we're going to wait and no child shows up 9 months later? And will we look like we're not quite with the church, you know, with the program? On the other hand, you know, I had this feeling that, gee whiz, this sounds a whole lot better than Gail's branch president, so we'll just kind of ignore him. Now, because I don't, at that point, didn't communicate very well, I didn't really stop, I don't think, to ask Gail how she felt about it, although she later on said, you know, a little bit later on, certainly before we got married, said, "Hey, I'm buying your branch president, not mine. This doesn't work for me. I've been 3.5 years or 3 years to school. I want to finish the schooling. I'm not the cozy up with kids type, so I'm not anxious to have children right away," and which made me a little nervous, to tell you the truth. We were still engaged, and I thought, oh no, I'm marrying a Mormon woman that doesn't like children. Am I in for trouble? And we were able to work those things out before we got married, thank goodness. Although the birth control didn't work, we ended up having a child about a year later anyway. So it was all for naught. But I thought that particular incident epitomized to me this whole issue of free agency and choice. And I probably should have stopped to think a little bit more about that as we went into marriage, because as we went into marriage, I saw Gail becoming more and more frustrated and tormented. She did what supposedly she thought was best for her. She stayed home. She didn't write. Although she did finish a little bit of schooling, and unbeknownst to me, there was great torment underneath the surface, because she felt like she had talents that she needed to use and develop, and she wasn't happy unless she was doing it. There were a couple of issues involved with me in the process, though. It made me real nervous. There was a selfishness issue on my part. And I readily admit that, because who wouldn't want to just come home, put your feet up, watch TV, wait for dinner, and man, that's the easy life. That's the life of Riley. And she raises the kids. That's great. Yeah, I'm there, and I did my duty. I brought home the paycheck. Wrong assumption, I found out. And Gail helped me see that. I think there's an insecurity issue. I've seen this in friends more than our marriage, where what if my wife, and I have some friends in California in the advertising business that this happened, what if my wife earns more than I do? If she goes out, gets a job, earns more than I do, maybe becomes more popular, more famous, more wanted than I am, will she still want me? It's the insecurity issue. I see that in friends. I think I'm covered on that one. But there's the other issue that I see and felt in the beginning was a control issue. Wait a second here. The church teaches that I'm the guy that says who's supposed to say the prayer at dinner time. That I'm the guy that makes all the final decisions. Yeah, everybody has input, but it all rests on my shoulders. And so this is my family. I need to control this. This is me. And that, I suppose, I had a little bit more problem with, because I mean, you're raised that way. My dad was that way. My mom was very giving, never, I don't think, argued or said much in the way of defense in her opinion. And she's a good soul. She's a great soul, but in retrospect, and even nowadays, I think she's coming out of that. So there's that particular issue as well. Well, I've said enough. I guess to conclude, I should simply say that I knew Gail when she felt trapped, and as I know many other wives who still feel that way. And she was afraid to the point where I was afraid to act happy when I came home from having a good day work or a great round of golf or something like that, because the fact that I was happy and she was trapped at home supposedly made things even worse and created more difficulty and conflict. And both of us had to feel bad in order to feel equal, was kind of the way it was. Fortunately, Gail worked through that, and me, I'm probably still, frankly, quite gun-shy. I will sometimes go so far as to say, Gail, can I play golf today? Is that okay? So it's kind of reversed, and I shouldn't have to do that either. I mean, but we've worked that out, and I'm pleased that we have. I think, frankly, I mean, any smart person here on the panel will tell you that there's basic things like that you have to deal with: selfishness, willingness to sacrifice, understanding that the church isn't the enemy here. It's you yourself that's the enemy. You need to work with yourself on those things. I'm grateful for the True Confessions kind of book that Gail wrote, because it's good for me as well as for her. Hopefully it's good for a lot of other people as well. Having said that, I'll be quiet and let the experts speak now.
All I can say is I'm grateful my ex-wife did not write a True Confessions book about me. When I was first approached by Gail to be on the panel, I was a little bit confused about why men ought to be talking about this particular topic. But now, as she has framed it, I can see that perhaps I have something to add. Unlike what was just described, I have to sort of understand things in an intellectual context first, and then I can start relating to them a little bit differently. And in that light, I've tried to, as I've observed things through my life, I've tried to understand why things happened to me, and in particular, why my relationship with my ex-wife was not a successful one, and why my relationship with my children appears to be a successful one. And I am not sure that I have all the answers, but at least there are some things that I've observed that give me some, at least some light and some comfort. The first thing that it seems to me that successful relationships are based upon is true equality. And I think that pertains to spousal relationships and relationships with your children. The only difference between you and your children, for example, is experience. They may be smarter than you, they may be more talented than you, and one has to look upon the close relationships you have in your life, especially your personal relationships, as one being based upon true equality. And I'm not talking about the kind of traditional equality that is referenced in the politically correct joke that's going around right now about men and what they think is an equal relationship is one where the wife cooks the meal and they eat it. That simply isn't the way it works. It is a different kind of equality than that. I'm talking about an equality where you look upon the other person, be it your spouse or be it your child, and you recognize in them, number one, that they are from God, and that they have a separate, worthwhile nature simply because of who they are. That is part of their birthright. And then you look upon them and understand that they may be brighter than you. They may be more talented than you in a variety of different areas. And if you look upon them in that way, then you begin to understand, I think, about the kind of equality I'm talking about. It's axiomatic, then, that this kind of equality is destroyed when one attempts to control. And it seems to me that control can happen in two ways. One is where control is actively taken, where one of the two spouses, and this just doesn't go where it's typically the male, but it certainly is not always the male. I'm sure all of you have had experiences where the controlling party in the relationship is the female. So there is a situation where control is actively taken, and then there's a situation where the control is ceded by the one who doesn't want to take the responsibility that comes with control. And I think that's probably what we're talking about today, is a situation where, for a variety of different reasons, women, probably more than men, cede control. Men cede control in certain kinds of their lives to women. I'm sure that a lot of men don't choose their clothing, for example, because they believe that their wife is better qualified or capable of doing that. A lot of men feel their wives cook better than they do, and they cede control in that way. But I'm talking about control over some of the important parts of the relationship. And when this control is ceded, at least in my experience, a couple of things happen or can happen. The party who cedes the control frequently, and this may be a combination of these things, but what I've seen is I've seen people who simply cease to exist as a separate person. They are totally an appendage of the dominant person. And that leads to consequences that I'll talk about in a minute, it seems to me. The second is that frequently the person who is controlled engages in a form of guerrilla warfare as a way of trying to balance the relationship. And this manifests itself in sickness. It manifests itself in snide remarks in public situations where the other spouse cannot retort. It manifests itself in undercutting the authority of the dominant parent with respect to the child. It manifests itself in a whole broad variety of ways. But in my view of things, I think frequently that is a way of sort of psychologically balancing the scales. And it is not done in a direct way, but is done in a very indirect way. On the dominant side, or the controlling side, frequently the party loses respect for the person who's controlled. And as was described earlier, sometimes there is a fear of change. It's very comfortable to feel like you're... The reason people, it seems to me, take control of situations is because they're afraid of the uncertainty that is inherent in all human interaction. And the problem is the exercise of control, or the ceding of control, fundamentally destroys the ability to interact on an adult-adult relationship. So frequently what happens is you create parent-child relationships where the dominant becomes the parent and the controlled person becomes the child. And in a certain kind of perverse way, this is incestuous, because you're trying to conduct an adult relationship in a way where the psychological realities of the relationship are much more akin to being a parent and a child. Now, in my own particular situation, I was married for 14 years. I've now been divorced for 7. It was very important to me that I be a parent who interacted with my children. The fact that I could not interact successfully with my ex-spouse didn't mean that I ceded my responsibility as a parent. And so my children have lived with me for the last 7 years. Well, I've got a son who's now on a mission in France, but my daughter is still at home with me. And I think perhaps that experience has also given me a greater appreciation of what it's like to be a single parent, which the burden typically falls upon females in our society. Now, I've been fortunate in the sense of not having to have the kind of financial problems that many single parents have, but I know the kind of problems that come when you drive for 4 years to the orthodontist appointment every month and take time off to go to baseball games and do all the kind of things that usually parents can share when you have two at home. Now, in my own particular relationship, in trying to understand why it developed the way it did, I'm not exactly sure of all the reasons, but my ex-spouse was is a French citizen. No, I didn't serve my mission in France. And I suspect that the seeds of it, at least part of it, was in the fact that she came to a new culture. She was not familiar with it, and we began to develop bad habits in the beginning. She came to rely upon me because I knew how the culture functioned. Part of what I brought to it was that I tend to be a take-charge kind of person, and my personality is that way. And so it was, when we melded together at the beginning, we did it for reasons that were, when you can understand from a psychological standpoint, but they were unhealthy in the long run. And so early into the relationship, she was ceding significant control to me because of language differences, because of cultural differences, and because of just the way that she had been raised and the way that I had been raised. And what I found is that in many respects, the church sort of reinforced that. If you have very sort of defined roles that you expect out of people, and the church certainly has defined roles that it expects out of people, one of the, at least in my own experience, I found that many of the principles of the church are good in certain contexts and bad in others. And what I found that I was doing is I thought I was being the dutiful husband, that I was doing all the things I should be doing, and when things didn't go right, I would even try harder to make them go right. And what I should have done was drawn back all the way. Because fundamentally with such, it seems to me that you can't make them work. They either work or they don't work, and you make them work. The only way you can make them work, it's very imprecise, but the only way you can make them work, at least in my experience, is by letting go, letting loose. And it's in this morning's panel, one of the people from the audience talked about Section 121, and that's what I think that's all about, is letting go. And when you let go, you take the risk that the person's not going to be there, but at the same time, you know that if they are, and if the relationship is on a fundamentally healthy basis, that they're there for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons. Now, the way it manifested in my relationship was that I would try to fix it. And it always seemed that when I was told that, well, if you do this and this and this and this, then everything will be okay. And then I went out and did this and this and this and this, and then I'd come back, you know, a month later, and there was a whole other laundry list. And I'm not one who remembers things that happened in the past and keep sort of a balance sheet in my relationship. I'm just not that way. And I would get these things that I'd said 10 years earlier that would come back to haunt me. And after a while, what you do is you tend to withdraw, and you tend not to interact. And what you find is that the person, at least in my situation, she ceded this control, but she was very angry about it. And the anger manifested itself in a variety of different ways, all of which were very unhealthy. And so I'm not exactly sure how you get out of these situations, but I am sure that if you're in a relationship where that there is this inequality, then it is detrimental to the kind of relationship you really want to have. And in my own experience, you know, I wasn't successful in solving the problems because as people are free agents. And I sort of, in many respects, view myself as a Christian existentialist in the sense that there are things that we simply don't control. And one of the things we don't control is the other person's agency. And if we think we control the other person, we are really, really kidding ourselves. And so what we need to do is draw back and redefine the relationships on some kind of different basis. And that's how that's at least what I've learned out of these set of experiences. Thank you.
I may sound shy or nervous, and it's not that. This is an emotional. It's an emotional issue for me to even be here, and I'm going to explain a little about why that is to you first. But if I sound like I'm scared to death, it's probably because I feel a lot about what I'm about to talk about. I'm a counselor, and Recently I heard a child ask his mother why they were going to this doctor. She says, because he's a heart doctor. And I agree with that. We really are therapists for people with broken hearts. This issue of women and free agency, what it does to us and our lives and our children is not pretty, isn't funny. It's hurtful, and it isn't something that is something that... that's cute. It isn't something that's laughable. It is something that's extremely painful. I've also lived with, for 21 years, a woman who has struggled from the day I met her to overcome a dictatorial father, a cold mother, who struggled every day of her life to love and be loved. And I'm really proud of her. She's gained that freedom. But it's taken her 21, 22 years. And no, I wasn't always helpful. You can't really be helpful as a therapist to your own wife. You just make every mistake every other spouse does. But another discomfort I have at being here is I might say something that offends somebody. And I have all kinds of thoughts in my mind from my own father that, oh Lord, everybody has to like me and I must not say anything that's offensive. And if someone is offended at what I say, something really terrible will happen. And I don't like that. I hope I offend some of you. If I say absolutely nothing that you disagree with, what is the point? So I'll try to. The words I'm about to say to you come from therapy, with all the biases that therapy has, dealing with people on a day-to-day basis, week after week, with their pain and their problems with these issues. Yeah, I'm biased. Biased in favor of people becoming real, of feeling what they feel, of saying what they need to say, and not being so damned afraid that someone won't like it. In Gail's book, when I first knew she was writing this book, I went up to her and told her, you're going to get in trouble, Gail. Someone is going to be mad at you. And I was afraid for her because I hardly knew her, but I sensed her to be a kind and gentle person who's very sincere. After reading the book, I don't think that will happen. Were I to have written the book, I would have gotten all kinds of trouble. She's very gentle. She's very nice. And throughout the book, I sense she's trying very, very hard to be fair to everybody. I'm not so fair. I try to be, but I'm not always that way. I do think the LDS Church and men in general do a great deal to harm women and could do much more to not harm women and men. And Gail kind of indicates that it's not the church, that it's people and their interpretation. And if women just believed they were free, then they wouldn't have all this problems. Well, I think it's kind of a combination of both. I'm not anti-Mormon. I just expect more than I see sometimes. Control to me is the opposite of love. To the extent we control someone, we hate them. Control comes from fear, usually, or a desire to dominate and control people. It's interesting to think about the first great reunion of people when we once got together, and I guess we were all there, right? We're told we were. And the issue was over freedom and control. And countless people I have in my practice, day after day, week after week, forget that Satan lost. And they think he won. And that we're out to control people so that they see no R-rated movies or hear no awful language, even though they go to the neighbors and do it. And I don't have a thing with R-rated movies. It's just a little trite example. Satan lost, folks. People are free. You can't take anyone's free agency away from them. But what you can do is this. You can shame them. You can make them feel ugly. You can make them feel angry and resentful. You can make them not love you. But you can't really control anyone. All they do is kind of go underground with it. And what comes up on the other side isn't very pretty, and it isn't very loving. The question to the panel was, how do you know, or how can you tell if a woman doesn't exercise her free agency? What does it mean to exercise one's personal agency? Is it to think for oneself? To feel one's feelings? To make choices based on what a person wants and feels is right for themselves and others? Or is it to conform what others think is right? Is it to ignore or to numb one's feelings? Or to make choices out of fear and conformity? Some common symptoms I write down of a woman, and of course we men don't do it, but of course we do. Anyway, these are some symptoms that I have found with people who don't exercise whatever this free agency thing is. They're perfectionistic, rigid, see things in black and white terms. They approach things with a very rigid stance in life. And the way I like to illustrate it is it's kind of like they are a sheet of glass on the prairie. And it's beautiful and it's very strong and very rigid. But when the wind comes, the glass shatters and it goes everywhere. What we really have to be in relationships and with our children is more like a blade of grass. And when the wind comes, we bend, and the wind goes right over the top of us. Does that mean we have no values? No. It just means we value people's free agency more than our knowledge of what is right for them. People who don't exercise their agency have tons of resentment. It feels like they're not living or conducting their own life. And how couldn't you resent that? They also have a lot of fear. If she says what she feels and believes, she may be abandoned, left, or rejected. And of course, we're just talking about women. Which I think is kind of funny because I've always felt this way. Anyway, people who don't exercise their free agency believe that their own needs, wants, feelings aren't as important as those of the people around them. To be oneself may hurt others, and therefore they don't try to be themselves. They try not to hurt others. Sometimes you can't do both. A lot of times, Mormon women or men who don't exercise their agency use truckloads of trite phrases. They speak Mormonese. You guys know what Mormonese is, right? Something that's totally acceptable to every Mormon person, and no one will ever be offended by anything you say. It's easy to say they have low self-esteem. I don't know how you measure self-esteem anyway. I've never, ever been able to figure that out. But what I think it might be is a combination of low self-esteem, low self-worth, but then something I consider even more important, and that is low self-awareness. When we don't know who we are, we can't love who we are. You can go to tons and tons of classes. You can take workshops. You can listen to tapes about loving oneself. You can give yourself positive affirmations. They seem so silly to me. I'm sorry, but they do. Silly unless you know who you are. When you know who you are, then you certainly can begin to love who you are. If you love who you are and know who you are, why would you want to control someone else and prevent them from knowing who they are and loving who they are? The question was asked, how can men help? I don't think they can, most of the time, because men aren't as far along in terms of knowing who they are and what they feel as women. Since I really mean that, I'm not being facetious, maybe since we can't help women find out who they are and exercise their own freedom, maybe we can at least not shame them when they do. Maybe we can at least give them permission and encouragement and love to do it. And maybe, in reality, we better do it together. Because I think men need more help than women in this. Okay, I have to go quick. Gella's threatened me very seriously. Okay. I'm going to talk very briefly and quickly about a client. I've changed all the names and dates to illustrate how I see this not exercising one's agency. 44-year-old female comes to therapy, multiple problems with children, with spouse. She's depressed and empty and worn out. Last week, her husband bought a boat. She is furious, but doesn't dare tell him how she feels. She doesn't dare tell him how she feels about anything, whether trite or whether important, because feelings are so uncomfortable. She doesn't want to live in Bountiful. But she remembers her mother telling her a good wife should be happy with her wherever her husband finds a job. She never talks about not liking Bountiful because she doesn't want him to feel bad, and it doesn't matter at all to her how she feels. She has trouble with and enjoying sex because of a grandfather who sexually abused her. She doesn't dare tell her husband or talk about it because that would imply to him that she doesn't enjoy him, and she has got to protect his feelings. It doesn't matter to her how she feels. Consequently, sex isn't fun, it is work. She believes that they must hold family prayer every evening and every morning, and they must have scripture reading. They have 5 teenagers. Now, I don't understand how anyone can believe in doing that. Because at least one of them is going to make it such a hell on earth that you're going to soon give it up. She believes her husband doesn't support her 100%, but she doesn't dare tell him because he might leave her, or he might go away, or he might feel bad. I'm not exaggerating this lady. She is bright and competent and decent and good. Her husband, his point of view is, all he sees is her pain, her depression, her anger, her numbness, and her coldness. He feels hopeless and helpless and discouraged. Nothing he does is ever good enough. He has no hope of anything ever improving. He just goes on and works and hopes that someday this life will end and he'll go to his peace. The children. All the children see and sense that something is wrong. But what do they label it as? They have all kinds of problems expressing their feelings. Then when they get to be 14 or 15 and they have all kinds of sexual issues, identity issues, authority issues, it all comes up and it all erupts and no one can talk about it. Now, no one can talk about children's feelings when mom and dad don't talk about their feelings. So the bottom line is, for me, I suppose, a person who doesn't exercise their free agency, doesn't take responsibility for their own life, does not know how to feel. They don't know how to feel who they are, what they want, where they're going. It's hard for them to express anger, discouragement, etc., etc. Now, there's tons of other things, cognitive issues that Gail brings out in her book. But I'm a heart doctor, remember? So that's what I choose to talk about, is the feelings. Treatment. How do you treat someone like this? There are certain characteristics of a healing relationship between therapist and client. Why can't it also be the same between a husband and wife, or wife and husband, and parents and children? And these are the characteristics of a good therapist, and we'll talk about the characteristics of a bad therapist. A good therapist is, number one, warm. Bad therapist is cold. Good therapist, unconditionally loving and accepting of the client as they are. Bad therapist is judgmental. Good therapist has empathy and unconditional positive regard. In other words, you make a real effort to understand where that person is, how they feel, and how they got there. A bad therapist takes no time or effort to really understand how the client feels. From research in England, where everyone can go to therapy because it's free, they have found that people who go to therapists who have these negative traits get worse. People who go to therapists who have these positive traits get better. Doesn't matter what the training or the sex or the experience of the therapist, what matters is his ability to be warm, empathic, and genuine. Okay. So first of all, if a man is going to help a wife or a friend or a daughter with these problems, you got to have that kind of therapeutic relationship with each other, where it's okay to be who you are, where it's safe and where it's warm, where it's friendly, where it's genuine. So that's what you do in therapy. And then you do one additional thing. You have to go back into feelings. How many of you remember the old Poltergeist movie? When the girl got slipped into the TV somehow, sucked in there by all these spirits? It's a great movie. It's my kind of movie. Anyway, there is a time in the movie where the woman, the mother, has to rescue her daughter. To do so, she has to tie a rope around her waist and jump into the monster. And that's what we have to do with this whole issue. We have to go into ourselves, into our feelings, into our past, into the pain, into the things that you don't want to think about, into the experiences with mom, with dad, and with everybody else that shamed and hurt us, not because they meant to, but because they were also shamed. Okay, you go, you do that. You can do that with your wife, with your girlfriend, with your children. You can do it in therapy. Then what comes out on the other side? The person has to begin experimenting with expressing feelings. And the first time, wife says to husband, I can't stand Relief Society. Husband says, well, tell me why you say that. Not, oh no, what is going to happen now? People have to practice expressing what they feel and what their honest experiences are. One of the healthiest things you can say to your children when they come home and they say, I hate Susie, or I hate somebody, or I hate my Sunday school teacher, is, well, tell me why you feel that way. This thing happens when people begin to take these feelings out of here and begin putting them out here, and people out there say, that's okay that you feel that way. Then they have less hate, less anger, less resentment, and all of the positive feelings begin to come out. I think the whole process is similar to having a big puncher wound in your rear end, you know, great big and deep and painful and full of infection. And it covers over very quickly and you walk on through life as if nothing was wrong. What we have to do is we have to open it up and let the infection out. And we do that by expressing what we feel. Is it scary? Threatening? Yeah. But it's also very healing. If you practice this with your loved ones, you'll experience something amazing. You will bond together like human beings should. Thank you.
Like the last speaker in the sacrament meeting, where everything's been said, so I should just give you the monologue from Jay Leno. But the Olympics have been on, and I haven't been watching Jay Leno, so I'll ad lib. When Bay was talking about his experience with his branch presidents and getting contrary advice, we followed the Vernon Law advice. That is, we decided that my wife's younger than I am, and she wanted to finish her degree, and so that was fine. So we put off kids for a while. So we decided to which kind of birth control we were going to use, and then some 8 years later, we found out that we were infertile. And my thought at that point was, all those frustrated nights for nothing. I don't have any special expertise, except that I'm in the middle of my midlife crisis, and so is my wife. And if you can plan it, don't plan it to happen with the same time as your spouse. It's not something that's very, very commendable. I do want to refer to the book, because I think it's a good book, and you should read it. I've enjoyed it. It's a very readable book, and it's full of anecdotes, lots of stories about different people. And you can read them fairly quickly. But in reading that many anecdotes, you'll find some persons that resemble yourself. And you'll see yourself in a lot of those people, and you'll see their conflicts. And that's very healthy, I think. One of the things that Austin was talking about is how reluctant we are to admit to ourselves and to others that we have problems. And the remarkable thing about this book is that it is full of the stories about people who have problems. And that's nice to know. It's nice to know that you're not alone. There are lots of people out there who are in pain, who are dealing with the same kinds of things that you're dealing with, and it's nice to know that. And it would be helpful to meet those people and talk to them openly. But instead, you go to Austin or somebody like him. But it'd be nicer if you didn't have to pay for it. I'd like to just read a couple of passages from the book that I hope will illustrate the kinds of things that we've been talking about. I do want to tell one other anecdote from my own past in the spirit of Jay Leno. And that is when Dave was talking about, you know, what will people think if we put off having children? Well, we had to face that because for 8 years we were infertile. And it was nothing that we had control over. Still, people made assumptions. They made remarks. They said things. I remember once when I was in graduate school, I was at University of Southern California, and it's a fairly expensive school. And our elders' quorum president, a well-meaning but rather tactless man, came up to me and said one day after priesthood meeting, well, when are you going to do what you're supposed to and start your family? Okay? And you've all had experiences like that where sometimes you're just taken aback and 4 hours later you think, I know what I should have said, you know? But you can never go back to that moment. Well, I surprised myself. This is the only time it's ever happened. And I said, well, we had three, but we sold them to pay for my education. and it was, I don't know where that came from, because I'm not that witty. But anyway, it was one of those great lines that happened at the right time, and I didn't have to wait 4 hours to think of it. Let me read from page 42, if you have your books. If you don't, then you can just remember that. She's talking about kind of a realization that she had. I think this is you speaking, isn't it?
I was listening.
don't remember. You haven't memorized the book?
No.
One day the realization hit me, and with it came intense feelings of exhilaration. Freedom doesn't come from having control of all life's circumstances. Rather, freedom comes from relinquishing the reflexive grasping for outward manifestations of security and from understanding that there is no real security in mortality. Freedom primarily consists of whatever inner peace and security we've been able to develop through our faith in God. I think that's a very good definition of the kind of agency that the book is striving to describe for us. And the opposite of that may be control, or the word that's used often in the book is codependence, where we depend on something or someone external to ourselves for our own identity, self-esteem, whatever that is, or our own image of ourselves. And you can start to see when we depend on external circumstances for a reflection of ourselves, you can see how threatening and how scary that is, simply because then you have to control those things so it will reflect back to you the image that you want to see. And the control issue becomes very, very important. I think that whole attitude is inimical to the way I understand the gospel, which is when Christ says, the kingdom of God is within you. That is, you don't need to depend on external circumstances. You don't need to depend on external anything, because the kingdom of God is within you. That is, you have the resources for that tranquil, calm, peaceful feeling, coming to grips with your problems, feeling assured of yourself, and dealing with that on your own, and not having to depend on anything external to yourself for that feeling. And I think that's the essence of the gospel of Christ, is to have that kind of self-assurance. We often talk about Christ's meekness, his gentleness, his kindness, his unconditional love, but he got angry. And he never apologized for it. There's remarkable power in being able to be angry and not having to say you're sorry, because your anger is justified. That is, I think he was fully in control of his feelings, and he never had to second guess them or apologize for them or feel guilty about them. That's a very interesting thing for me. I think I am afraid of my feelings many times, and I think it's many times I end up doing things and then having to apologize for them. It's not that you shouldn't apologize when an apology is needed, but I'm thinking of the kind of ideal person, which would be someone who is so in touch with his or her feelings and could express them without regret. And I hope that I can become that kind of person. Let me move on to another passage that I think is very remarkable, and it's on page 78. I love this story. This is a story when you got a job for Intermountain Healthcare, and you had to do some traveling, and traveling was one of the things that she feared. She feared being off on her own, fear of having an automobile accident, feeling being accosted. All kinds of fears came into her mind, and those are very understandable. But she went out on the road, and she said, her husband Dave says, "Hope you don't die." I didn't, nor was I raped. And much to my surprise, there was a tremendous amount of exhilaration mingled with the fear. The job lasted a year, and while I can't say I grew to love solitary travel, the freedom I gained was incredible. Freedom to travel alone and freedom from an enslaving fear. There was also security and pride in comforting my fear, in confronting my fears and winning. Since then, I've taken several long and short road trips, and with my children, when Dave was unable to join us, I'm still afraid of air travel, but continue to impel myself onto planes when the need arises, and I don't run home from sleepovers. Okay, that is the monster that I think Austin was talking about. We all have fears. Freedom, I think, is eventually comes from you know, jumping into the TV or jumping into the monster, confronting that fear and winning. And that is an exhilarating feeling. It's also very scary. And I think the longer you put off dealing with your fears, the scarier it is. And so when we have those fears and we bury them deep and then have to confront them later in life, it's a very, very traumatic prospect for us. Very, very traumatic, but also very, very exhilarating. All right, and then the other passage that I really like is on page 89. Let's see if I can find it. Well, it's when you learn to relish insecurity, and I can't. Okay. Yeah. Oh yes, there it is. Thank you. Then came the fun. I took Scott Peck's words to heart when he wrote, "The only real security in life is relishing its insecurity. Instead of trying to manipulate external circumstances so they reflect back the politically correct or the religiously correct or the economically correct or whatever image that you find represents your ideal self. Instead of trying to manipulate all those mirrors out there, it's kind of exhilarating or kind of fun to think about relishing all of the cracks in the mirrors and all of the stains and all of the wrong angles and all of the ways that they reflect not back at yourself but give you a skewed picture of something. And relishing in that, relishing in the insecurity of the external circumstances. That's a very helpful kind of thing. I hope I can arrive at that also. Well, I've used up my time. But I fully agree. In fact, it was I almost wrote the very words that Austin spoke. He said, I was talking with my wife and just before I came up today, and she's the child of an alcoholic father and is just now dealing with that alcoholism and the way it affected her family and affected her in particular. There are other circumstances. And this morning, she got sick, and I was trying to prepare for this presentation, and she was in the bathroom retching, and I had to go to school to do some things, and I had to finish reading the book, and I had to go down and pick up some other stuff and run about a dozen errands, and I thought, damn it, why did she have to do this today? You know, of all days, why did she pick today to get sick? And I realized that I have a lot of resentment in my own life for things. And we sat down this afternoon after she was able to get up and started to talk about our feelings. And I'm very buoyant right now because the first time in a long time we've been able to talk about our feelings. And she said to me, as I said, I've got to go now or I'll be late. She said, say that you can't be free. You can't be a free agent until you know yourself and how you got that way. And she added that. And the difference for me, the importance of that last addition and how you got that way, is agency is different from motivation. That is, we're all motivated to do things. Many times our motivation is is inscrutable to us. We don't understand why we do certain things. But the key to our exercising our agency, I think, is in knowing why we do the things that we do. And it does demand confronting the monster. It does demand going into our past. It does demand experiencing some pain and trauma. But as the book fully points out, the other side of that is very rewarding. And so I commend you for writing this book. I enjoyed it, and thank you very much.
I should pay him to repeat that lecture everywhere for book sales, I'm telling you. Okay, we have now a half an hour for questions and answers, and I'll just, I need to repeat the questions into the mic, or if you want to, you can just come and say them directly yourself into the mic, because they tape every session, and I'm supposed to say at the end that there are tapes for sale out there. Do you have any questions? Yes. Okay, the question is, to Keith, does he think that men really want, quote, the traditional wife, I think would sound...
I'm afraid that they do in many respects, and that's what is particularly disturbing to me, because I think it's a false. They expect benefits out of it that are truly false, in the sense that what they want in terms of self-affirmation, in terms of loving relationships, in terms of all of the kinds of things that we're motivated by in our very basic senses, are subverted by having someone who is in a controlled situation. Because what you reap is just the opposite. You reap resentment. Like I say, in my mind, you either get the guerrilla warrior who is finding ways to cause problems, to subvert what you want in the long run, or you get someone who is so dependent that they are non-functioning in terms of any kind of adult relationship. And so I think one of the ironic things, if I don't know whether any of you read any of Simone de Beauvoir's stuff, but she has written, I think the existentialists have something to say about this, and the idea is you let go. And in letting go, much more comes back. If you want to read Kierkegaard in the sense of a Christian existentialist viewpoint, but if you want to read a feminist viewpoint, go get Simone de Beauvoir's stuff, who is a great existentialist philosopher in her own right. And the point was, in her case, for example, she was married to Jean-Paul Sartre, and he had a wandering eye, and she would frequently come home and find him in bed with some other woman. And she was very troubled by this, and she didn't know what she could do about it. And from the existentialist standpoint, she looked at it and she says, there is nothing I can do about it. So what she did was, she said, there's nothing I can do about it, but I can start dealing with how I deal with it, the kind of feelings I have towards it. That's the control that you have is over the things that are inside of you, your own feelings. You look inside of yourself and you start understanding those feelings. But getting back to the point, I just think that we really are kidding ourselves if we think that we can have what we want in terms of a relationship, and it's based on inequality. And if the traditional, I think the traditional roles for women in society are really caustic to equality in relationships. And I think what we need to do is we need to let people experience and be who they are. And some people have talents to work outside of the home, and some people have talents to work inside the home. And I don't see any reason why the men can't stay at home and do the work if that's where their talent is. So I just think that's a false dichotomy that we set up for ourselves.
Okay. Any questions? Yeah. Do you want to speak into the mic?
Would you repeat it?
Sure.
Okay. One is, does anyone on the panel know of any successful the husband and wife both working part-time each and then spending the rest of the day with the kids? Has that ever worked?
Mm-hmm.
You know of some cases?
Well, I have partners who do that.
Sure.
Yes, and sorry, the question was, does anybody know of successful relationships where basically you have each party spending half time? And that's the ideal. We got to recognize the reality that, you know, we have to bring home, somebody has to bring home the bacon, and that's an objective reality, but there's no reason why that can't be a shared responsibility. But you see it in the opposite, too. You see professional women who are feminists at work, and they come home and they do all the laundry and cook all the meals. I mean, we still haven't broken out of that idea into the concept that really what we have here is a partnership, and both parties ought to roll up their sleeves and do the work. One of the reasons I was absolutely insistent on having a relationship with my kids more than a weekend relationship, and our relationship, the custody relationship, started out originally as a joint custody relationship. We bought a house a mile away from my place so the kids could go from one house to the next each half week. They'd be in the same school district, have the same friends, and so on and so forth. But I didn't want to give up the opportunity to be there when the kids have bloody noses, scraped knees. I mean, that's what parenting is all about. And out of that comes the satisfaction that all of us want. You have to pay a price in order to get something, and a lot of men figure they can get it on the cheap.
What was your other question?
Okay, we're told in church that there has to be a head. That's the way the Lord wants it. And that head gets to be the gut, arbitrarily. Now, my question is...
Does the church still say that?
Yeah.
Do they?
Okay, first of all, it says there really has to be a head. Is it possible for there to be equality, and does that work? I mean, do the parents present a united front to the kids? What if they're not united on a certain issue, does that work? Does there have to be one head?
Okay, I'm going to address the head thing, and then as far as the united front, I think I'll turn that to the psychologist, because Dave and I are terribly ununited front when it comes to our children, and it has been a problem. It has been. He has a much more stricter background with raising, you know, the way he was raised than I was, so it's been a conflict a lot. But as far as the head, it's funny, my parents are on a mission in Denmark right now. And as my dad and I was just there visiting him, and my dad and I were walking along the beach, and we had this funny argument fight about this very issue. And my dad, you know, being the age that he is, he was saying exactly what you said. You know, he thought he'd really caught me. You know, he said, "Now, Gail, you know, of course, that in a relationship, someone has to ultimately be the authority. I mean, if you get in a fight, someone has to decide what's going to come out in the wash, you know, and it's got to, and of course you know it's got to be the man." And I said, "No, Dad." no, Dad. I said, "That is not how it works in our marriage. That is not how it works in our life. In the way it works in our marriage is, yes, sometimes he does ultimately decide when it's a conflict, and sometimes I ultimately decide. No one's keeping track. We don't have a tally sheet. But I think I really feel like that we have to both be heads, and that we both have to make decisions, and that we both have to learn the art of submission and compromise in our lives." And then on the united front, I'll hand the mic to Austin.
And since I think in terms of slogans, as the mic goes by, I'll just make a silly little slogan comment: two heads are better than one.
Yeah, that was my comment.
Good point. I want to address the first issue about being a head in the family. Examining my own life and dealings with women, I've come to a point where I really need women in my life. I need their ideas and their influence and their power. And I'm not just saying that. It is a reality. And I think our children need them. And I think they need us to be a head sometimes, or, I don't know another word, not the boss. Maybe the authority. The woman is the authority sometimes. It's like we have areas of expertise in a relationship. I have some, she has some. We have to give that to each other. Sometimes I see my wife do things out of, it's not training, it's more out of a feeling in her heart of how to do it that comes across much better than I know how to do it, and she needs to do that. I think in a balanced relationship, yeah, they can be equal. A man may decide that they get an Edsel instead of a Cadillac, but the woman may decide all kinds of other decisions along the way. About a united front, I think there's all kinds of research that shows that kids need to see a healthy relationship. They need to learn about relationships so they can have one. Relationships aren't always united. That's impossible. I remember once a psychologist spoke at a Relief Society meeting. It's one of the funniest things I have ever seen. Anyway, he said at the beginning, he introduced his wife, and he said at the end they had been married for 25 years and they had never had a disagreement. Well, I got to give the closing prayer. And so I prayed that he would realize that his wife had been deceased for 25 years. Now, of course, I really didn't do that. But it's impossible to have a healthy relationship where you don't disagree. And kids can see the disagreement, but then what do they need to see after that? They need to see people who care about each other enough to compromise. The father doesn't have to always win. The wife doesn't always have to submit. And I would think it would really grate on a woman to submit to something she knows is wrong and she knows more about. And yet she has to play this silly little game about pretending her husband knows everything about everything. I think it's time we have to face the reality that women know more about some things than we do, and we know more about some things than they do, and then even sometimes our kids know more than we do. Sometimes we need to listen to them.
As long as the mic's here.
Gail addresses this in the book, and I can't remember because I didn't jot down the page, but she makes the that at times when you receive advice from local and general leaders, you still have the responsibility to decide for yourself what's best for yourself. And that may be contrary to the advice of your leaders, because after all, you know your circumstances better than they. I think we misconstrue the idea of a general authority as a military leader. General in the sense of non-specific. They give non-specific advice. And if it's good advice and it pertains to me specifically, that's my judgment. And if it doesn't, it's also my judgment and my responsibility.
Questions? I forgot. The question is, she asked the men on the panel, how would they feel if his wife one day decided, this is a very interesting question, that she was going to buy a house, and without too much a discussion or ado, she went out and found the house that she wanted and put down a down payment and came home and told him. How would they feel?
I think I feel real ticked off, and that hits a little too close to home, so I'm not going to expand on that at all. We just went through maybe the same scenario with a car, and so, I keep learning lessons. Yeah, and obviously something like that would need to involve both. I mean, you don't do that. Almost behind somebody's back. Are you divorced?
What did your husband do?
I want to relate a funny experience. I had a client once, a woman who wanted a picture window in the front of her house. And she kept wanting it and wanting it, and the husband wouldn't do anything about it. And so she had a guy come in with a jackhammer and knocked out a hole in the wall. And it turned out that the wall was a bearing wall. And so the whole front of the house fell in. And I think that can happen to relationships, too, if we're so insisting on having something and doing something, we can knock the foundation out from the relationship. But it's obvious to me that you're good at things like that, so you should do them. And your husband recognizes it. I wanted to mention, do we have time for a quick anecdote? Do we have a minute? Okay. At my graduation, Barbara B., down at BYU, Barbara B. Smith spoke. And she told about being young and being raised, I think it was in Vernal. Now, it might have been Duchesne. It was somewhere out in that area. It's been a while. I can't remember. And she told how her mother had all these little children, and I can't remember how many there were, but I think there were quite a few. And her mother left the family, the father and the children, and went back east to go to medical school. And then she finished medical school and came back to Vernal, I believe, and was a doctor there for many years and delivered many prominent people and saved many lives, and she spoke a lot about that, and it was really a neat talk. Right after she spoke, one of the general authorities got up, and I won't mention his name, I'd like to, but anyway, maybe this is being taped, so I don't dare, but anyway, he said, none of you women can ever leave your families and go to school. He says, that is not the way it is. And as he spoke, Barbara B. Smith just sunk lower and lower and lower in her chair. And I've never forgotten that experience, and I don't recall the experience with anger. I recall it with sadness, because thousands and thousands of people, and that was a big audience, and what, half that audience are women. And half of that audience are being told, hey, you can't go and do this. You can't leave your family. But I can leave my family and go to graduate school, and that's okay. But anyway, no, that was an interesting experience.
My wife has much better judgment in those matters than I do, and she frequently demonstrates that, and Besides that, there's a phrase in my patriarchal blessing that says that I should pay attention to my wife's advice in business matters. And my wife knows that phrase.
You know, I have to say, I think it's really fascinating, this lady in the yellow, how she said, how would a man feel if, you know, blah, blah, if his house bought a house and came home? Well, of course, we all were thinking that it was her husband that did that to her. So we were all thinking, oh, that rat. Well, it was interesting to me when you said it was you that had done it. You know, my response was, oh, that lady has guts, you know? Yeah. But if he'd done it, what a rat. I just, it was so interesting thought. And the other thing that I have to say, and then I'll get right to you in the back there, is the situation my husband was alluding to very briefly. He wanted to get a new, quote, used new car. And I don't like that kind of car that he got. And I said that I didn't like it. But the thing is, I, being the free agency person that I am, didn't want to infringe on his free agency. It's his car. He drives it 95%, 99% of the time. So I stated, I don't like those kind of cars. Why do you have to get another car? Anyway, and that was about it. And he came home with the car. Then he had to take my car to girls' camp that weekend and left me with his car, which I hate driving and I can't drive for a number of reasons. And I was full of all kinds of rage. And so this is sort of I don't have any real great resolution for this, because it's like, well, I was trying to give this man his agency, but at the same time ended out feeling all of this anger at him. You know, I don't know. Maybe Austin would have some brilliant answer to that. But let me go with this question in the back. Austin, restate the question and then answer it.
I think he said, as you're helping someone get away from being codependent or full of anger and not exercising your free agency, how do you know that you're on the right track? That is really a scary question. I ask myself that all the time. In terms of my profession, you'd check out things like, you'd have them record their dreams, night dreams. You kind of get clues as to whether they were going in a direction that seemed healthy for them. You'd monitor closely how they were feeling about the situation. I remember one lady recently who's starting to become independent of a neighbor lady friend, the bishop's wife. And the bishop's wife constantly tells her how she's going in a backward direction. Well, she's not a bad lady. What she's feeling, I think, is loss of the friendship, because this woman is becoming so independent. And I think the way to tell maybe she's going in the right direction is she feels better. Her mind feels freer. Maybe she's able to love more. She's able to give more with less resentment. But I think your question is really a fascinating one. How does a therapist or a friend or a wife or spouse really know that they're encouraging something positive? Maybe we have to pray about it. I don't know.
It's sort of interesting if you look at church history in this context, because in the early days of the church, the women had much more authority and much more freedom than they did in the later days. Certainly they had much more authority and freedom up through the early part of Brigham Young's administration. And then the church was a supporter of women's suffrage, but that was, in my opinion, more of a political necessity to have more voters who would outvote the non-Mormons in the Utah Territory for purposes of statehood and control of what was going on. But in my opinion, a lot of if you really look at church history, a lot of really important changes happened from 1900 to 1920 in Joseph F. Smith's administration. And you get a rationalization of theology in the sense of Witzel's stuff and B.H. Roberts and Talmage's works, and you get the church become less of a Pentecostal church. There's some writing that's been done on the changes in terms of the speaking in tongues and things like this. But there's also a change in terms from the middle of Brigham Young's administration on. You start seeing a change in terms of how women were viewed, and it became a much more Victorian view of things, and there were very hard and fast roles that were given to women. And I think only now are we beginning to break out of that. And we've lost a whole generation of really capable people, women, who feel restrained by these very rigid roles that the church has tried to impose upon them. And that's a great tragedy, one of the greatest tragedies. And the church is trying to address it, but I don't know whether they know how. At least in my perception, and maybe I'm totally wrong on this, but in my perception, it's not going to change until the patriarchy changes, until the church ceases to emphasize patriarchy and starts emphasizing that each person has their own human worth and we don't have rigid roles in little boxes we put people into. And once we do that, then each person can become what they are. And some people will be good at raising children, and some people will be good at working, and it has nothing to do inherently with their sex identity. It has to do with the kind of talents that those people have. I know some men are going to be a lot better raising kids than their spouses would. And once we get to that, then we can start addressing it. But we're sort of stuck in our doctrine. And I don't know whether it'll change or not, but I think that until that happens, we really are not going to get out of it.
Okay. We have about 1 minute left. Does anyone have any? Okay. We'll just end the session now, and thank you all for coming.